Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the University of Mississippi. Is everybody in the room masked, or do we have other things too? Or hands up anybody who's not a mathematician. Wow, that's a scary crowd for some people, isn't it? You know, actually, it sort of reminds me of a story that maybe sort of explains everything that's going on for all this stuff. Because actually, I was flying up to Frostburg in where is Frostburg?
Maryland,
right? Yeah, and to give a talk up there. And I got on the plane, and I sat down next to this guy, and he said, well, what do you do? You know, that's what happens on the plane. And I said, well, I'm a mathematician. And you know what he said, right? I hate math. Well, you know, this is the way of it. This is the way of it. And but he didn't say that, which maybe was even more scary. He said, oh, good. And I thought, this is a long flight. This guy. And he said, because I'm in the insurance industry. I said, really? And he said, yeah, and I'm about to take an exam. And I said, oh, yeah, this is really giving me a long flight. And he said, and there's this part of the exam that I don't understand. And maybe you can help me. And I was thinking, what do I know about insurance? You know, I don't know. I said, well, you know, maybe I can learn something. You know, you show me what it is, and maybe I can see if I can help you. Well, so it was compound interest. So I thought, this is cool. I could do this. And so, you know, so we worked through several, you know, I worked him through several problems, and then I got him to try to do one. And it was like, what did you do? And that was, you know, that's what it's all about, isn't it? You know, the experience, I never met somebody who doesn't teach mathematics, who teaches mathematics who doesn't agree with this statement, that mathematics is not a spectator sport. There is no way to learn mathematics if you don't do it. You know, I'm desperately trying to learn to play the guitar. I've been trying to do it for 2 or 3 years. And for some reason, watching other people play the guitar, it's helpful. But I don't seem to get to be a better guitarist by watching them. And in many ways, that's what all of this is about. It's all about realizing the fact that somehow students don't learn by osmosis, that somehow it's important that when, as teachers, we get up in the classroom, that we give a very clear and cogent presentation, but that's not the be-all and end-all of it. And instead, if we're able to first of all hold them accountable for doing the work, so they actually really do have to do some work, and then what's more, providing a framework where they can do that work in a helpful kind of way, well, then that's going to be a better kind of learning, a better kind of learning experience than one which my guess is all of us went through, where we sat in a room and watched somebody else do a bunch of stuff. And my guess is that isn't really what we did, because the very fact that we are here talking about educating others about learning mathematics means that we were good at mathematics. And my guess is that meant that we did the stuff. You know, if you think back to your experience, you were the ones who did the work. And so in many ways, when we look at our students and go, I can't understand. Well, yeah, because we weren't them. We weren't the ones who found it hard, who found it difficult, who found it tough to sort of to break through, who didn't understand, and so consequently found these kinds of experiences difficult to get to grasp. So that's what I want us to talk about today, is really that sort of the sort of journey to find some kind of a way that's a better kind of way to learn mathematics. But I also want to put a little bit of a sort of a plug in for you being you not being afraid to think of this type of idea, this type of learning, as being somehow peculiar to mathematics, because I don't think it is. Because I think there's a whole bunch of different disciplines that share that same kind of idea. Right? There are a bunch of disciplines that somehow they have two things going on. On the one hand, there's a body of knowledge that you simply have to know. You're like a bunch of vocabulary that you need to learn. And then also, on top of that, there are a series of important skills that need to be mastered. Not every discipline somehow falls into those categories, but when you have a discipline that somehow easily falls into that box, then something along the kind of lines that we're going to talk about today will work very naturally in a subject like that. You know, so you think about something like, for instance, language acquisition. Clearly, if you're learning a language, well, you have these two different skills. On the one hand, you have to know vocabulary. It's really difficult to speak a language unless you know what the words are. But just knowing what the words are doesn't really help. You have to learn the skill of being able to put it together. You know, people who talk about mathematics as being, you know, an international language, that captures that idea. And similarly, you know, music skills and, you know, there's all kinds of different subjects out there that very readily fit into this. I don't think it's true that all do. I was given a talk before and a philosopher said, well, how is this going to help me? And I was, you know, I had to admit, it seems quite difficult to imagine how something just like this would work very readily in a philosophy class. Because it doesn't seem as though philosophy easily falls into that box. It doesn't mean that these are some of the ideas that I'm going to say just completely fall away. I think there are ways to be able to redesign many courses, but it's very much easier, very much more natural in many subjects. So I think it's worth thinking about that. So what have we been doing here? So I want to turn the clock back. You can see that, I don't know if you know who I am, but once upon a time I used to be department chair here, and now I'm not. So, but now I'm the senior fellow of that. When you go outside there's like, and look over kind of in that direction, there's a big building site over there on the right, this big kind of yellow-clad looking building. That will be our new residential college that will open, fingers crossed, in August 2009. And so I'm going to be the senior fellow of that. So I'm involved in getting that whole project off the ground. Clearly, I couldn't do that and be mathematics department chair. That would sort of be suicidal. So, but what I want to do is to talk about some of the changes that happened while I was department chair. And when I took over as department chair, I think we were going through something similar to what many schools are going through right now or have just been through. Our chancellor did some wonderful things, or is doing some wonderful things at the university, and one of the things that he's done is to gradually expand the enrollment here at Ole Miss. We've gone from a school that was more like about 10,000 up to a school that was more like about 15,000. And funnily enough, our departmental budget did not increase by 3/2, and neither did our staff. I don't know if that's atypical, but I'm guessing that it's really not. And many schools are going through the same sort of idea. And so there was that, and then there was also this situation where somehow I very much have a feeling that I very much want students to learn mathematics if they're going to take a mathematics class. I don't care whether they're doing intermediate algebra or college algebra or a graduate class in graph theory. If they're going to take a mathematics class, I want them to learn it. That seems what education is all about. And so one of the things that I wanted to do was to look and to see how we could really do a good job in the classroom for all of our students. And it seemed as though it was very natural to begin with the classes that were the most populous, because that way you impact as many students as possible, as quickly as possible. Now, of course, I was too green behind the ears at the time to realize that actually, across the university, this is going to be very welcomed. Right? Because classes like college algebra and intermediate algebra and perhaps elementary statistics or whatever those introductory math classes are that are on your campus, everybody takes them, right? Everybody comes through your doors and takes those classes. And so as universities look at sort of roadblock classes and the freshman experience and all of those kinds of things, the things that affect things like retention and just time to graduation and all those kind of important parameters, exactly the kinds of classes we're going to be talking about today, they feed into those things. At the time, I really wasn't worried about any of that. I just wanted to see if we could do a really good job in the classroom so that we could actually get students to learn more mathematics. And what I realized was that, you know, the way that we traditionally teach college algebra, well, we get students to do problems out the back of the book, right? I mean, that's what we do. You say, yeah, do these dozen problems out of the back of the book. And then you perhaps you collect it in next time, and then you grade it. and then you hand it back. Well, then there's several days that have gone by between when you took it in and when you give it back. By then you're on to something else. And even more, when the students get it back and they look at it, they say, well, how many did I get right?
Yeah.
Right? There aren't very many students who go, oh, wow, I got that one wrong. I need to go and do 10 more of that one because that's the one that I don't understand. There aren't very many students who do that. I must admit, I was never that student. I mean, I don't know that anybody who does that. But clearly, if we're trying to get students to learn, that's exactly what we want them to do. So it seems as though having some kind of a phenomenon where students would be able to work problems and once more would be able to get feedback when they got it wrong, that would be a really good thing. Now, so let's put that to one side and think about education. So often, I think, we think of face-to-face as being kind of the gold standard of education. Right? If we can have small classes and put people face-to-face, then that has to be the greatest. Okay. We also somehow have this myth that if we take that and you put a computer in a room, it's going to get better. Right? Because, I mean, clearly, I'm talking to you right now, and the fact that this screen is here looking blue, that obviously improved everything. It doesn't make any difference at all. It's not like it's some sort of magic box. You put the computer in the room, everything gets better. Take the computer out of the room. None of that's true. So what we wanted to see was whether it would make any difference. If it didn't make any difference, what's the point in looking in that direction? So let's look and see what we did. So what we did was we did a pilot. Now this is looking back now several years. So this is back in 2002 that we started this pilot. We were in a little bit of a different situation than many. We already were in a situation where we had a standard final exam that all of our sections of college algebra took. So I know that may not be true at your institution, but we were lucky enough to be in that situation. I say lucky enough because it's really difficult to know whether or not you make any kinds of changes if you don't have a sort of a fixed goal to begin with. That makes things very difficult. So we were already in that situation, and then what we decided to do was to do something actually rather modest. We were going to replace the homework portion of teaching the class and change it. So instead of just doing traditional, just do it out of the back of the book homework, instead we were going to use one of these newfangled computer software things. Well, clearly you couldn't do 100 of them, so we chose two. We chose to use MyMathLab, a product from Pearson, and we also chose to use Hawk's Learning System. We chose them for several reasons. The first reason we chose them was because they seemed to be the most influential players in the game at the time. Hawk's had been around for a very long time, and we liked that. Pearson also had been around not as long, but a significant amount of time. Pearson is an extraordinarily large publishing firm, and so we somehow felt that they would be behind their product. We'd had some bad experiences in the past with some of the publishers kind of doing like do the hokey cokey. You know, they'd step in and say, yes, you've got a product, and then we use it in the classroom, and they'd go, whoa, you know, we're using it now. But we that just didn't sound like a good idea when you have 1,000 students doing a course. You just don't want that going on. So we didn't feel like, we thought that both of these companies would stand behind their products and would work with us and would be willing to make changes if we thought they needed to have changes made. They also had a different kind of learning philosophy, which I'll talk about a little bit more later. And they also had two different formats. So right? The Hawk's Learning System is a piece of software that actually runs right on the machine. And the MyMathLab piece of software is a piece of software that's web-based. So in that sense, we really, you know, it seemed as though if there was something to find, we were going to find it because we kind of had as many bases as we could cover. We also wanted to be really careful that we weren't just discovering who was the best teacher. Because let's face it, if you just have different teachers going on, it may be that it's just a different teaching style, maybe a different grading. Who knows what's going on? So what we did was that when we set up this pilot, the first time through actually they did a Hawk's Learning System. This was two sections in a fold. So incoming freshmen. And then the second, the next fall, we got exactly the same instructor to do exactly the same thing, but this time instead of setting the examples out of Hawks, she set the examples out of my math lab. So in that sense, we weren't discovering anything about teaching style. And then we compared her results in those two sections against four sections that were not taught by her, but they were also taught by very experienced instructors who I think have a very similar kind of teaching style. And those four, you know, their teaching evaluations have been very stable over a number of years. So it seemed as though that was a very reasonable kind of comparison. That if, you know, this somehow represented all that was good about what we had previously. So if it really was going to be true, if it was going to be true that it was going to be kind of marginal, we were going to find that. Because, you know, clearly I could have chosen four sections taught by graduate students who were in the classroom for the first time. I think we would have beaten that. That could easily happen. So that's the pilot. So these are the results. Right, there's lots of bars on there, so let me unpack it a little bit. Oh, so first of all, let me explain what this is a chart of. Right? This is a chart of results on the final exam. We had to choose what we understood by success. Right? And at the time, like I said, I wanted us to be teaching more math to our kids. We just wanted our kids to learn more math. So in that sense, rather modest, but maybe rather important. We just wanted them to learn more math. And it seemed as though a good way to see whether they learned more math was just to get them to take the final exam they'd always taken on pencil and paper, just like they'd always done it. And if they just do better, it seems reasonable to imagine that they actually learned more math than they did before. All right, so the blue, these are percentages on the final exam, and the blue one, you can see, that's when we use no software at all. And you can see the average is in kind of like the high 70s kind of thing looking, and it's a normally distributed curve somewhat, and it's sort of what you would expect. The red is my math lab. And you can see that the red and the blue, they're not that much different from each other. It's also kind of a normally distributed looking thing, and the average is somewhere around 70-something. You can see that they kind of, you know, about, 12% of kids get A's, it seems, like 90s and above, and it seemed like a few fewer kids get B's, and a few more kids get C's, and a few fewer kids get D's. It's sort of, you know, and it's tough to tell right here whether that's just kind of noise that's going on or whether there's something causative there, you know. But it looks as though just by looking at it with the eye, that there's not that much between the blue and the red. You don't have to do a sophisticated kind of statistical technique to see that the yellow is something different. And this was what I got to look at after we'd done our trial, where you look at this and you go, well, we have to look more carefully about this, because clearly something significantly different happened with the experience for these students. Because, I mean, look, the mode outcome was a 90%. Now, this is 100 students. It's not 1,000 students. It's one teacher, not like 25 teachers. But still, something different. The same teacher taught the class that was yellow and the class that was red. And we went back and looked to see whether there was anything underlying in the ACT scores for that class. Or, you know, was it a different population that came? Was there anything unusual about what was going on? We couldn't find anything at all. And so it seemed reasonable to imagine that something significant was happening because of the software that we introduced, the only thing that we changed. Let me show you some math, so I guess we can talk about some numbers. So you can see that the mean for the Hawks changed from the no software by about 4%. So again, let's think about what that might mean statistically. We can already see that the whole shape of the distribution changed, so there's something significant that happened. But is it statistically significant, this change in the average? The standard deviation there is about 15. So we had 100 people in the sample. So in other words, a change of about 1.5%, that's a change by one standard deviation for the distribution of the mean. It's nice to be able to talk some math, isn't it? It's kind of cool. So what we're looking for, if we change by 3%, that would be two standard deviations. Well, you can see we almost moved by three standard deviations. So yeah, this is significant. You can also see that actually in my math lab, the average went down. It went down by, well, a little more than one standard deviation. But, you know, on the scale of standard deviations we're talking about, it's a hefty drop, and one that you couldn't dismiss. You'd have to look a little more carefully. Yeah, so on the weight of all of this, it's really clear that we chose to use my math lab in the classroom. No, we didn't. Of course we didn't. There's no possible way that as department chair I could look at these results and choose anything but to use that software in the classroom, right? Even not using it in the classroom would be irresponsible. If my provost came to me, well, you did this pilot, did it do anything? I say, well, yeah, it did this. And she said, so are you using it? And you said, well, no, I don't know. You know, this whole software thing, not so sure. I'm not so sure she would have been very happy with me. Do you think so? It's clear that using that software made an enormous impact for our students. The question is how are we going to scale it? Right, how are we going to implement this over a broad number of students rather than just in a single section? And that was the huge challenge. As I say, this is going back. This is back in 2002, 2003. We didn't know what NCAT was. This is a ways back. So we had to think about how it would be we would implement this on a larger scale. Well, what is nice is that I went to my provost with the data and she was supportive. And I think actually in many ways it's important to realize how visionary that was, because it really was something so radically different from the kinds of things we'd had before. And she was willing to give me some money, and with that money we opened up a lab. We opened up a computer lab, and it has 80 computers that are in it. And now it's open about 60 hours a week, and it's staffed with our graduate students. We're not allowed to put, and I don't know that I would anyway, we're not allowed to put our first-year graduate students into the classroom. They have to be here. They have to have 18 hours of graduate mathematics before they're allowed to go into the classroom. Rules vary in different institutions in different states, but that's where we are. And so, in that sense, I have a large number of students who, they're not allowed to go in the classroom, and so what can they do that's useful? This is something that they can do that's very, very useful. And more than that, actually, it's a very useful experience for them, because they work with students one-on-one, and they also learn the kinds of things which students find difficult. You know, when they go into the classroom for the first time, they spend a whole year working one-on-one with all the students who raise their hand and say, can you help me? So they know the kinds of things that students find difficult. They know the kinds of questions that they want to ask. They know the kind of issues that raise themselves in the classroom naturally. And that helps them when they go into the classroom. They can't just ignore that. But I'm getting ahead of myself in the sense that when we first opened the lab, we didn't do that. We didn't require them to go. We just said, hey, we've got this really cool thing going on. We've got this lab. And you know you can go there, and you can get tutoring in mathematics, and you can go as much as you want, and people will help you. Yeah, they didn't go. They didn't go at all. Some people went, but the better students, they went. The ones that we wanted to go, they didn't go. We sort of learned the hard way this idea that if you really want students to do something, if you really think that this is something which ought to be part of the course, require it. You've got to require it. Students like options, but optional means you don't do it. And actually, I must admit, when I take a sober look at myself, I realize I'm no different. It's not like there's some like strange, different kind of species or something. None of us habitually do things that are optional. We, most of the time, end up doing the things that we're required to do, and if there's time left over, then we'll do the optional things, right? If there are things we really feel like we want to do. And so what we realized was that we were going to have to change the way in which we taught the course so that this entirely new kind of teaching experience would actually be part of what it is that they would do. Now, it's all very well for me to say, well, what we really want them to do is to go through this interactive kind of learning experience, but if they don't actually do it because they never set foot across the threshold of the lab, that's all sort of wasted. So what we did was we took a bold step. We took a bold step. We turned around and said, okay, you know what? We think that this is such an important part of what it means to learn college algebra, and actually we embraced also elementary statistics. We did both of our two gatekeeping freshman classes. That we are going to require that you go. And in fact, what we're going to do is we're going to take some of the time which you would have traditionally spent in the classroom and turn around and say, we won't have you in the classroom anymore, we'll have you in the lab. And we'll just think of the lab as being the classroom instead. So that's what we did. And what we did initially was, there are constraints, right? Based on the fact that universities have schedules and things like that. We just can't do anything that we want. And so Monday, Wednesday, Friday classes, we couldn't really see how we were going to somehow do that, right? Because there's three classes. Tuesday, Thursday, that was more natural. Tuesday, Thursday, what we said was, okay, what we're going to do is you can go on Tuesday to the class, or you're going to go to Thursday on the class. The other one that you don't go to, you're going to go to the lab, and now you can go anytime you want, because scale is our friend. Right? Because we have so many students, it really doesn't make any difference whether they go the time that they're scheduled or they go any time that they'd like to. It was sort of nothing for us to give them that liberty, and meant to not for them. As I say, students very much like options. They just don't do optional. So when we gave them the option of saying, you can go to the lab any time that you like, it was open anyway. They very much liked that. It didn't feel like it was quite so much of an imposition. And we actually got them to go. All right, so this is what happened when we went to full implementation. This is statistics now, so you can see that we just didn't do this in college algebra. This is not just a single pilot section. This is an entire year's worth of grades. So there's about 1,500 odd students who are involved in this now. And the blue is where we were before, and the yellow is what happened when we went to this full implementation, where we said, okay, remember, actually, this is actually in a mixed situation. This was actually the situation where some of our classes on a Monday, Wednesday, Friday, they just were required to do the homework, and we didn't require them to go to the lab. They could go if they wanted to, but they didn't have to. And Tuesday, Thursday classes were required to go to the lab, and they also were required to go to the classroom. And you can see that, you know, there's a significant shift in the distribution. Now we get a normal distribution, which is exactly what you would expect, right? You know, when we go to a full implementation, to imagine that we're going to get this sort of this increasing kind of thing, that really was never going to happen. There's no way we could have hoped for that. But for us to see a significant shift, that's what we wanted to see. And, sir?
Did you repeat again what you said about the Monday, Wednesday, and Friday versus the Tuesday, Thursday?
Yes, I can. Okay. This is not the model that we use now, but it was the model that we used then. So what we did was Monday, Wednesday, Friday was literally the model that we used for the pilot. We say to students, we want you to do the homework. The homework is on this piece of software. The software is installed in the computers in the lab. We also installed the software everywhere else on campus. So it was in the library. It was in the main student computer lab. We have a software installed everywhere. They could also install it on their own machines. And we simply asked them that they did the homework on the computer. We could see whether or not that happened. So it was literally analogous to what it was, sort of the smallest step from do the stuff out in the back of the book. For students who were in the Tuesday, Thursday classes, which is about half of them, instead, we said, if you're in a Tuesday, Thursday class, we'll ask you to go to the classroom only for one hour and 15 minute section a week. And instead of the other time that you would have normally been in the classroom, we will require you to go to the lab and spend time working on the machines there. It may be that you work on your homework. It may be that you are working on this, you know, some kind of a practice. It may be that you're simply working through learning issues. It may be that you're asking questions, but we will require that you do your work there. Everybody was using the software. The Tuesday, Thursday classes just did better. I mean, they did. And the trouble was then to try to find some kind of way to to implement that over a grander scale, because the trouble is that 3 is not divisible by 2. And so how could we make that work? I mean, you know, I can't stress enough the fact that in many ways these redesigns, they're a learning process. You know, the trick we found is to make definable steps and at each stage know where you were so that you can see whether or not what you did actually, did it have the kinds of effects that you were hoping for. The Tuesday, Thursday classes did do better, even though they were in the classroom for less. And so in that sense, we felt good about the fact that, okay, we made a good choice in the sense that, you know, people thought we were lunatics at the time to say, well, look, they're only in the classroom for half the time. How are they going to learn? In retrospect, well, you look back and go, well, okay, that wasn't such a tough choice. It sort of was a tough choice at the time. Again, let me show you the numbers just to be complete. The change in the average for statistics was actually much, much larger. You can see we changed by about 8%. Again, on that same sort of scale of 1.5 being a standard deviation. So it was an enormous change. And I can't stress enough, these are grades on the final exam. It really is true. It really is true that we were able to impact final grades also, but embrace the fact that you have so much more liberty about how you distribute the points in your course to decide what the grade distribution is in a class. Right? You don't have so much liberty on a final exam. So in that sense, making impacts to the grade distribution is a much easier thing to do than to impact a cumulative final exam that's given in a common format. Just because, you know, there's all kinds of things that go into the final calculation of what final grades are. And so this seemed like it was a much finer kind of test for success than just saying, okay, fewer students fail. Important as it is that fewer students should fail if we're to succeed here. What we realized that we had to embrace was the fact that these large multi-section classes, I think we've naturally thought of these large multi-section classes as being just exactly that. A bunch of classes that were all the same, taught by different people. And we needed to change the way in which we thought about it to realize that there was a bunch of people all teaching the same class. And that's not the same thing at all. The instructors who taught this class were very willing to embrace this idea and to get together and to begin to talk about what it was that they were delivering in the classroom, how it was that they were delivering it, whether or not there was some consistency as to their expectations of what the class might be, and their expectations for the standard that they were expecting in different segments of the class and different topics. And I think that's, you know, you put your finger on something enormous. How often have you, I don't know, you've read somebody else's exam and you've read yours and you go, whoa, my students wouldn't even be able to understand what that question was because they phrased it in a different kind of way. So exactly those kinds of things are the kinds of things which I think overwhelmingly we would like to sort of eliminate those kinds of things, because let's face it, if your students are so clued in to exactly the way that you phrase the question, when they go and take that work that you did with them to another class with another teacher who says things in a different way, they're not going to be able to understand that either. And that sort of defeats the purpose so much. So that is an extraordinarily important kind of concept. The fact that now, for this redesign to work, it's suddenly embracing this idea that we want something overarching, that we're going to go at a course, and instead of saying, we've all done this, you wouldn't be here if you weren't innovative kinds of teachers who embrace different kinds of things. And my guess is you've gone in the classroom, in your own classroom, and you've made changes, and you go, you know, this really works, my students really like that. And you change things for the 30, 40, 50 students who are sitting in front of you for that particular semester. Those 50 students as a body of 1,000 students, or 2,000 students, or 500 students. It could be that by having that kind of collaborative effort with other faculty who are teaching that class, if that can be organized, then you can make that kind of impact not just in your classroom, but across a whole body of students. And that's a real change. You know, you think over time, we've been doing this for I guess, for 6 years now, and there's about 4,000 students who go through these courses each year. You know, so this is 20,000 students who have been through. I haven't taught 20,000 students in my entire career. My guess is you haven't either. So that's what redesign is all about. I think very often people think redesign, you know, when they hear this word redesign now, they think, ah, well, this is some kind of ruse to make money, some kind of way, save money. Or it's not like that at all. It's the way that I think of it is it's about thinking about playing chess. You know, if you play chess and you treat every piece like they're a pawn, you're going to lose. You're going to, right? Because all of the pieces come to the board with their own kinds of talents, and those are the things which you need to employ to play a good game of chess. That's what this redesign is all about as well. It's about realizing that as a team of faculty, if we all work together in ways that really embrace our own expertise, and if we have some kind of overarching goal, then we can come up with something that is vastly superior to each of the individual classes we might have done. And that's what redesign is all about. It's not about just putting it online. It may be that you come here to find out how to actually put a class online. And I'm certainly not just, I'm not downing teaching online. Teaching online certainly seems as though it has a very important role to play in education today. But I think very often that's the only way that people think of using a computer. Like they think of, if you try to introduce using a computer into the education of a student, then you're thinking about somehow just putting it online in some kind of an isolationary kind of way. You think of this experience of a student sitting in their dorm room or some distant location far away from the classroom instructor and let them kind of, you know, just get on with it. That could not be further from the way in which we've implemented our redesign. In fact, what we've done is we've actually increased the one-on-one kind of experience that students get. So you think about what happened before. Maybe I should explain actually what our redesign now is, the one that we finally settled into. What we finally settled into is that our students now, no matter whether they are in a Monday, Wednesday, Friday class or a Tuesday, Thursday class, they always meet for 2 50-minute segments a week, and they are required to go to the computer lab for an additional 50 minutes each week. So that's our redesign. Now, the 50 minutes is a little less than it might be. What we've discovered is that somehow the amount of time that we require the students to go to the lab is something of a red herring. Because once they're there, they're going to get what they need to get done. So many of our students spend more time in the lab than the 50 minutes. So that 50 minutes that we require in there, we actually get a much larger bang for our buck. And that's what it took a little while for me to figure out, I must say. So, let me also, before I go into that, say why it was that we chose twice a week rather than once a week as being kind of the final model. Notice we get this ultimate uniformity now. All of the sections are the same. So it was very good for us. We could now, you know, everybody's trained exactly the same way. We could have a common format, common curriculum, in the sense of delivering the material, common pace, all of that kind of stuff, which is very good for us. We chose two rather than one because what we found was many of the weaker students, they get disconnected from a once-a-week class. They only go once, and somehow, for some reason, they miss a class. It's 2 weeks since they've been.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we felt we were losing a little more than we were gaining. All right, so now let me talk about this technical issue of 3 and divisible by 2, and 2 is divisible by 3. So what I did was I went to my provost and I said, could I teach 3 50-minute segments in the time that these 2 1-hour and 15-minute segments are normally scheduled? And they said, do what? And I showed them that, see, our classes run like this. They go from 8 to 9:15, from 9:30 until 10:45, and from 11 till 12:15. Well, there's plenty of time in there to go 8 to 8:50, 9 to 9:50, and 10 to 10:50. And they'll still be in time for the 11 o'clock class if they want to be. The classes actually really fit in there properly. The only difference is that actually the middle one, you have to take up 5 minutes of their transfer time. But on a Monday, Wednesday, Friday, they seem to be able to get between classes in 10 minutes. So on Tuesday, Thursday, maybe they can do that as well. Right? So when my provost, when the administration looked at this and they said, well, what's not so sure about that middle one? I said, okay, well then we'll just forget the middle one. And I said, oh, okay. And I said, I mean, it's an awful shame that the class is just completely empty for an hour. It seems, almost wasteful for the class to just be completely empty for an hour. But, if you're comfortable with the class being completely empty for an hour and just scheduling this hour class at another time, that's good with me. And they said, why don't you put that class in that hour? Okay, that's good. So that's what we did. So it's actually a really good use of the time. And as I say, we gain a lot by being able to have this ultimate kind of uniformity that runs across. So on a Tuesday, Thursday, basically we do exactly what one would normally do on a Monday, Wednesday, Friday. We just teach 8 to 8.50, 9 to 9.50, and 10 to 10.50. The 8 to 8.50 class sits comfortably within the usual 8 to 9.15. Agree? And then what's interesting is that the last class, the 10 to 10.50 class, right, the 10 to 10.50 class, actually does sit almost within the traditional class, which runs from 10.45 until, oh, sorry, from 9.30 until 10.45. Right? The lateral piece of thinking is it doesn't fit at the beginning of that, it sits at the end of that. But you have to take up that extra 5 minutes. Agree? And then once you've done that, the class is now empty between 9 and 9.50. So why not teach a class in there? It's true that those students who were in a traditional 8 o'clock class cannot go. And it's also true that those students who are in a traditional 9.30 class cannot go. But there's a bunch of students who aren't in either of those two classes.
Yeah.
Well, let them go. That'll be fine. So that's our redesign. And as I say, I can't stress enough the fact that in all of these things, well, number one, I claim you need to be able to make sure that you make changes that actually create an improvement in education. Not something that you're content with. Right? You don't want to make changes and you look at the results and go, oh, that's okay. That's okay, but it'd be much better if you actually really did know that education happened and things changed. And I think you have to agree that we have that kind of change. That's what we set out to do, and we have that kind of change. More than that, you also have to be willing to embrace this idea of this overarching type of idea. I'm saying you can do so much more if you're willing to all get on the same page. Overarching now, again, let's think about redesign. You have to decide what success is, ideally before you begin. Because what it is that you decide success is going to change dramatically the kinds of decisions that you make. For us, success was that students actually just did better on the final exam. We wanted them to learn more math. It may be that your department is facing pressures about grade distribution. If that's true, that may be your definition of success. It may be that your department is facing stuff about, class sizes or, success for minority students or women in mathematics classes. There are all kinds of different, everybody's university is going to face different issues in that way. You have to sit down and go, okay, there's different kinds of ideas about what it is that we're trying to achieve here. Let's get some really concrete goals about what it is that we're trying to achieve. And then we can think seriously about the redesign we're putting together. Again, it's going to be different depending on where you are. At our university, students have, if they're going to withdraw from a class, they can do it. They just did it, I guess, six weeks in. Your university may be different. But some universities, that drop is way down the road, almost before they take the exam. Sometimes it's much earlier. All of these different facets, they play into this in enormously different ways. Again, we had that constraint of the fact that our schedule was set up the way that it was. If your schedule isn't set up that way, well, okay, you may have more latitude. It may be that you can very naturally, you know, do a kind of a over a grand scale, go with this kind of one-on-one idea. It may be that you're not persuaded with, you know, my feeling that I want to keep those weaker students kind of connected to the class. Maybe that in your institution, you're going to view things in a different way. That's going to change the way that you put this together. But knowing what success is and somehow recognizing it at the first, it's an important thing for you to know. What are some of the features of redesign that at least we were trying to capture? And I think they're the kinds of things that are worthy of capture. Active learning roles for students. Right? As I said, in our redesign, now that we have this 2-in-1, think about where we were before. Where we were before, students came in, they were in the classroom for 3 50-minute lectures a week. All right? There's about 50 of you here, maybe a few less, but roughly 50. Did I answer your question? If I didn't answer your question, why not? Why did you not ask it? Perhaps you didn't feel comfortable. Perhaps you were hoping somebody else would answer it. Perhaps you thought, I'll ask it later. Not everybody asks all the questions that they want to ask in a lecture format. It's just the way it is. Even if you were teaching in small classes, you have to ask yourself whether or not you're even actually using small kinds of class techniques. Now, if you're teaching a class of 20, do you really teach that class any differently than you teach a class of 50? If all you do is just stand up and just lecture like I'm doing right now, what difference does it make how many people there are in the class? It may be that actually having 500, there would be more questions just because there are more people. These are sort of, we don't normally think in this kind of way, I think. We bought very much into the fact that we think, okay, small classes equal better. Small classes equal better if we actually use the fact that there's a small number of people in the classroom. I can remember when I was a graduate student, having a class where there were 3 of us. Professor came in the morning, stood up, lectured on the board. I thought, there's 3 of us. He didn't have a conversation. It could have been 500 in the room for all he cared. Most of the time he didn't look at us. But so small can be better, but it isn't going to be better if you're not going to take advantage of that. Now, in the redesign that we have, yeah, it's active, but even more, look, when they're up there in that lab, if they want help, raise your hand. They're going to get somebody who's going to come over. They're going to spend as much time as they need to working with them one-on-one on precisely what it is that they don't understand. Even given the fact that perhaps they don't even need to speak to a human. The software itself, we're going to embrace as part of the teaching team. Because, as you'll see later, the software is clever. It does many of the things that we would very much like it to do. It's going to work, it's going to set the students to work a problem, and when they get it wrong in kind of one of the ways that, guess what, we just know, you know, that's why we set the problem, right? So that they would get it wrong and learn about that. Well, when it does that, the software comes back and goes, when you square things, you've got to remember that middle term. Don't forget about that. Here's another one for you to square out, so let's see if you can get it right this time. The software will do that for itself. So there's lots of support systems now that wouldn't naturally be part of a package of just a traditional 3 times a week, 50-minute lecture. This active learning is now something which we can bring back, which I think has disappeared from the classroom. So say, students, do options not optional. If there really are things you want the students to do, you need to require it of them. One of the things that we had to introduce was an attendance policy. If we want them to go to the lab, we somehow have to make them recognize that going to the lab is not optional, in the sense that we're going to check up if they're going to be there. We didn't used to have an attendance policy. We had to introduce one. It doesn't have to be tremendously draconian, because they're in college algebra. If they could do the calculation to realize how significant the amount of penalty that they get by missing really is, maybe they wouldn't be so persuaded by the attendance policy. But they can, because they're in college algebra. So the way in which we've implemented, they are free to use the software wherever they would like to, whenever they would like to. So it's perfectly fine for them to complete homework assignments at their, in their dorm room, in the library, in the main computer lab here on campus. But we require them to go to our lab. As you'll see later on when you look at the software, there's sort of two modes of learning in the software, which is one of the reasons why I think it's so helpful. I think there's a difference between practicing and assessment. Right? It's perfectly reasonable for you to try to practice a skill, and then when you feel that you've mastered that skill, to then be assessed on it. That's the way that we all learn things, right? But that's sort of not possible in the traditional kind of homework. Because I say to you, look, do those 20 problems out of the back of the book. There isn't a student on the planet who goes, oh, okay, well, let me do all the other 600, and then I'll do those 20 when I really feel that I can do them. Nobody's going to do that, right? But they should. It would be a much better learning experience. And so that's what's available here. And so what we encourage our students is to use that time in the lab as a practice time, for them to work those problems, and the software gradually increases in difficulty and leads them through material, and then that prepares them to actually be able to take the assess part. It may be that they end up doing the assess part in the lab. It may also be true that they end up doing the assess part at home. If they do the assess part in the lab, our lab workers are sort of under pain of death about helping them when they're in the assess part. They are not allowed to help them when they're in the assess part. They can help them as much as they like when they're in the learning part, but not in the assess part. Now, we are visiting as to whether or not to make it tougher than that. We are discussing right now as to whether or not we simply should just insist the assigned work needs to be completed in the lab. And the software would certainly support that. We haven't done that yet. If you think about, 80 computers, 60 hours a week, that's a lot of hours. And they spread themselves out. For a long time, I think for a very long time in education, we've somehow bought into the idea that on the one hand, we want students to do the work, but on the other hand, it's going to be true that they're going to be doing some work where they're not sitting right in front of us checking whether or not it's really them. And this is, in some sense, another of the compromises which we've had to come to say, okay, when we traditionally set homework, we had no control of whether it was really them or somebody else. And we're in that same boat, that when we do this homework, if push comes to shove and you say to me, do you really know that Jimmy did that? If Jimmy didn't do it in the lab, I really don't know if Jimmy did that. I agree. And it's always going to be true that students cheat. They cheat at your place just the same as they do at mine. And the old adage of when they do cheat, who do they cheat? They cheat themselves. Yeah, if they don't do the work, they're not going to do very well on the final exam or any of the other exams. What we found is that this interface is a very easy and accommodating interface. If you take any piece of software, there's going to be some sort of a learning curve. But what we found is that the learning curve here is gentle and short. And in many ways, that's about all you can ask. How easy you think it is, but our students certainly find that it's a very easy one to do. And the nice thing is for us, we use the same software in intermediate algebra, college algebra, and statistics, and also in pre-calculus. And so it can be that students take several classes with us now, and the format of the software is identical through each. So once they've learned it once, it's very nice. All the exams that we gave during the year, none of that's changed. We still use, and maybe, these days I sort of feel like an old fossil about it, but we don't. We still give, actually, in statistics they give 3 midterms, in college algebra they give 4 midterms, and a cumulative final in each, and those tests are delivered in the old-fashioned way, pencil and paper, write it down, grade them. During the way in which the course unfolds, what we decided was that it was actually healthier rather than simply having some kind of compromise exam that would fit for everybody. Instead, it would be stronger to have a common model for an exam and then allow each instructor to somehow be able to tailor the words a little. And so that's what we settled on. So all of the exams that are delivered, they're based on a sort of a common model. Instructors will change the order of the questions. Of course, they'll change the questions themselves. and they have a liberty, if they feel like they really need to change the words a little, then they can change the words a little. But basically the exams are, well, you know, they're identical in the sense that we mean it. When you, you know, if you have two quadratic equations and the numbers are different, we think of that as the same question. Stephen spoke about it. This is part of the, you know, this is part of the collaboration between the staff. We have a course coordinator for each of these classes who basically has the final say, if you like, but they will meet with their faculty on a weekly basis to talk about issues that haven't come up in the class, and also issues of grading and expectation and assessment and all of that. Yeah, so we try to keep that, there's a rubric that's given for the grading of each. And I think that's really important, because clearly there's a big difference between the way in which people migrate. People caught on very, very quickly. I mean, they really did. They were very persuaded by the success that we had, and it was very helpful in the fact that, like I said, my professorial faculty don't teach these classes. So these changes didn't change tenure track professors' day-to-day life. That wasn't helpful. And actually, the instructors were very enthusiastic about this. And there were a couple of people who were less enthusiastic. Once they started to see the kind of success that we were getting, they embraced this quite well. And they also were very encouraged by the... There are tremendous time savings that are involved in teaching in this kind of way. And people like that. You know, when you don't have to grade all of the homework that your students used to do, that's kind of a useful thing. You know, We even went as far as to have a common syllabus in our calculus classes that were taught by professors. So I thought, you know, while we're at it, we'll keep going with the momentum. The first time we did it, professors were going, well, I'm not quite so sure about this. Second semester we did it, they were emailing me going, where's that common syllabus? Because they figured out, if it's a common syllabus, we don't have to make it. Somebody else will make it. You know, these things are useful. So, it wasn't initially... but it came with time. All right, let me talk a little bit about what's going on in the classroom. I'll talk a little bit more about that when I talk about the lab, because it may be that you're thinking, well, yeah, I know what's going on here. It's pretty easy to be successful when you're not in the classroom for so much, so you just don't do as much work, right? They're only in the classroom for half the time. You just teach half the syllabus. I agree that would be a very easy way to go, but it's not at all what happens. What's required is for you, it is true, you're going to change the way in which you teach. It is true. Because you're going to be in the classroom for less, you have to be much more selective about the examples that you present, but you have to embrace the software as part of the teaching team. Because you know that the students are going to be in this lab for some significant amount of time each week, and you know that when they go and do that, they will be doing many of the problems which, if you had the time, you would present in class. But you're now buying in. So remember at right at the beginning when everybody said, yes, mathematics is not a spectator sport? Yeah. This is what it means. It means that it's not a spectator sport, that useful learning happens even when you're not there. And that's what's going on here. So yes, it is true that you're going to have to change the way you teach. No, it's not true that this is about watering down the curriculum. In fact, over time, the curricula that we have in these courses has improved. It has gotten... More of these classes have actually gotten more challenging because we've had the liberty to do that, given the fact that our students are doing better. We've been able to, in college algebra, put some topics back into the course which history has somehow eroded away, which is a nice thing, right? And in statistics, we've similarly been able to make the class much more a sort of critical thinking class than just a do you know how to write these symbols kind of class. So I think those are encouraging. Well, how many examples do you do in class? Again, you now got to prepare the students to then go and be successful for themselves. What if the software uses a different method? Yeah, if the software is part of the teaching team and you're talking to other professors, well, you better know what it is that the software is doing, because otherwise everybody's going to be confused. There are several ways to do different kinds of techniques. There really are, and you always talked about that. And you're going to talk about that now. So perfectly reasonable for you to say in the class, look, the software, if you ask it, is going to show you how to do the problem this way. That's a really good way to do it. Here's another way, which is also a very reasonable method, which you may have seen before. Use whichever of these two is comfortable, but make sure you get it right. Right? The problems appear when you show only this one way, and then students go, oh, I don't know what's happening. You know, yeah, that's all surprising. You do that too. Everybody can see that. All right, now, just to close up, let me not talk about college algebra. Let me talk about why you would bother to do this at all, except just for the goodness of your heart, because you want students to be successful. Right. I talked about, a long time ago, about the fact that when I started as the foreman chair, there were some significant challenges that we were going to meet. Look what happened. We had 966 students in fall 2000 taking college algebra, 300 doing statistics. And it took 26 instructors, 26 people going into the classroom teaching those sections. Fall 2007, the last academic year I was a foreman chair, you can see now we have about 1,800 instead of 1,200 students. So our enrollment increased by half. Well, so if our enrollment increased by half, well then guess what? The number of sections that we had to teach also have increased by half. So I should have had to use 39 people to teach those classes. So how are they going to do that? Are they going to go to my dean and say, you know what, I need 13 extra sections of college algebra and statistics? Maybe I could have done that. I don't know. Our rooms didn't get any bigger. Our rooms were full at the beginning. They're full now. One of the facets about what's going on here is, I said, there was a time saving. Our faculty were willing to believe, just as we weren't so sure that 2 was divisible by 3 earlier on, but I think everybody in here is willing to believe that 2 threes are 3 twos. Right? And so what I asked my faculty to do is to say, you know what? Once upon a time, a section was 3 sections a week. So if you taught 2 of those sections, you were in the classroom for 6 times. What I asked my faculty to say is, okay, now I'm only teaching in section 2 times, I can teach 3 of those sections. Now, let's think. They're in the classroom for precisely the same amount of time as they were before. It is not true that they have to do any more homework grading because the computer does it. It really is true that they're teaching more students than they did before. It is true that they will have to grade more final exams, so that will take more time. But we've already agreed that there's much that can be gained by working together. And so time which used to be spent deciding on homework problems and deciding on final exams and midterm exams and formats and all that kind of stuff, much of that can be streamlined. And so my faculty were willing to believe that, you know what, actually they come out about the same. And they really do. But it really is true that now to teach those students, even so, remember, we already agreed, remember my little joke, we already agreed that we should do this because students learn better. If it happens to be that students learn better and as a department we are able to use departmental resources in a much more effective kind of way, it seems somewhat churlish to say, well, no, I don't think we're interested in that. We were interested in that. In fact, more than that, we were in a position where if we were not interested in that, then as a department, our majors and our graduate students were going to suffer. Our program was going to get literally throttled by the fact that we would have to teach so many more students elementary level classes. And it may be that your department's in a similar situation. You see, look at, this has nothing to do with college algebra on its face, but it's part of the evolution of our class. Yeah, I know the writing's small. It's sort of almost for effect. These are the upper level classes that we taught in academic year 2000 and academic year 2007-2008. All I want you to observe is that there's more on the right than there is on the left. Almost twice as many. Well, how were we able to teach all these extra upper level classes to our students? Be able to offer a much more vibrant undergraduate experience? Well, it's because we went after teaching the classes, we went after changing the way we taught classes which had the largest enrollment. Yeah. So any kind of gains that we made there had an enormous impact in departmental teaching resources. And so, yeah, I was able to use some of those resources to teach more undergraduate classes and more graduate classes. And that changed the whole fabric of our department. Because look, again in that same year, we had 45 math majors. Overwhelmingly, they were BA students, so they really didn't do as much mathematics as we would hope. And our PhD program is on probation. We're about to lose it. Not that pretty a picture. After the redesign, our number of majors almost doubles. Look how many students are now doing Bachelor of Science degrees. So there's substantially more upper level math than they did before. And our PhDs, we graduate 23 PhDs over that 5-year period. We're not on probation anymore. Did we make all those changes because we taught college algebra in a different way? No. Could we have made those changes if we didn't change the way in which we taught college algebra? I don't know. I really don't. But it really is true that because we were willing to embrace this kind of redesign, it not only improved the education experience for our introductory classes, which is what we all agreed was that was a sort of a laudable thing to begin with, but what's more, it also allowed the kind of flexibility for us as a department to completely transform the experience that we gave to our majors and our graduate students, and had a correspondingly impressive effect on the research in our department and just the whole atmosphere of it. So I think in many ways, you know, even if you're not convinced by the impact in the classroom, every department faces these same kinds of issues of how do we distribute resources in a way which is the most effective. And there's a battle that goes on between classes that are service classes, if you like, and classes which are classes for majors. That's what this is all about. So what's all about. All right, now you listen to me plenty of times.